Welcome to the Ackerman Center podcast.
As a digital extension of the Ackerman Center, our goal is to teach the past so we can change the future.
In doing so, we address issues related to Holocaust, genocide, and human rights studies from diverse perspectives.
Hello, Dr. Romer. Nice to meet you here again in the studio. You've been kind of traveling around, and last podcast we released was about a walking tour through some of the key memorials around Berlin. And you're going to tell us today a little bit more about a few smaller memorials that you visited.
Thank you. Yes. When we go and visit Berlin, we are confronted actually by memorials, by museums that remind us in a very powerful way of things that have happened. But in many ways, part of what is so unfathomable to us is how do we connect the kind of individual places of living and of individual families that lived to what ultimately happened to them. And so over the years, in addition to the major memorial sites, emerged a whole slightly more fragmented and more dislocated smaller sites throughout Germany, but also very much in Berlin, most famously in the so-called stumbling blocks, little brass blocks that are kind of slightly elevated that recall the last location, living location of an individual or his family. But for many, in many other ways, the sites that otherwise have remained from where, for example, Jews very early on were deported, really, if we visit them today, we are looking at train tracks. We're looking at a landscape. There's nothing that really kind of reveals itself of sorts in the ways in which it does when we visit a former camp. We have to remember that a Holocaust, like other genocides, is not just the destruction of a people, but really their erasure, and the erasure also of any traces of their previous lives. And therefore, this podcast today is deliberately pulling together a number of these smaller sites that kind of connect those prior lives up until 33 to the, you know, eventual destinies of these individuals. And therefore, I'm leading you today through a couple of places that on the one side recall individual locations of Jews and where they lived, the houses in these so-called stumbling blocks, Stolpersteine, a very powerful art installation called The Deserted Room, where in many ways you kind of see the emptiness that has remained, the void, the absence. Together then with a shorter visit of one of the deportation train stations in Grunewald, which if one visits today, it's a beautiful little suburban train station of sorts with these tracks, however, that remained. And today these tracks are not used any longer. They just kind of go into what appears to be a forest, a very powerful reminder of the individuals and their families that were brought here to then be deported to their, at that time, unknown destiny and their eventual fate, dying in many of the camps. So these are slightly different sites, but that kind of tied together the absence and the voids with some kind of historical recollection and memory.
Hi, Dr. Romer and Angie Simmons. I'm glad to be you guys here online. Dr. Romer, it sounds like you have a lot of noise in the background. Can you tell us where you are? And it sounds also like you're walking around.
I am very much walking around. I'm in the middle of Berlin. It's kind of evening, so it's kind of dark, but I'm walking around. I'm alongside a subway, so on and off we hear these screeching noises. I think it's from the subway. Right now I'm essentially on the kind of side of Berlin that used to be part of the GDR, what we call East Berlin, on the other side of Alexanderplatz, a place that often... Just let this one pass by, an U-Bahn. The Alexanderplatz that is usually often associated with the big radio tower. But for us, this is a really important part because this side of Berlin is, you know, very close to the famous museum island where you can see the Pergamon altar. Not too far from here in the other direction is the now often controversially discussed Humboldt Museum with its kind of colonial possessions. But we're not here for any of that. We're actually moving toward what used to be a part of the traditional center of Jewish life in Berlin. So while today tourists often come to Berlin and are attracted to the Jewish Museum or to the memorial to the murdered Jews, they less frequently come to this site. But this is actually the site where much of Jewish life began and where some of the central institutions were created. And so we want to like look a little bit at that, and I'll tell you something about it. And then in particular, I want to look also at how the memory of the Holocaust in Berlin is really not just simply an issue of big museums and memorials, but also something that is preserved very locally. I'm now bringing us to a place called Koppenplatz. And at the beginning, there's a smaller installation, which is called the Deserted Table, or the Deserted Room, I believe. Kind of backing into it from the wrong side, I think, right now. I'm on the end of the park that is a playground and set up for table tennis. So bear with me as I'm walking around. This park, again, is just surrounded by residential houses, older houses, actually. There's quite a bit of older structures that were preserved here or rebuilt partially, and therefore this whole area of Berlin has a kind of very historic feel to it. The installation has a poem attached to it, but let me just first of all describe a little bit of what this installation is. Again, it's just in a simple park that is otherwise serves, you know, people to take a break as they're walking around. There are benches here, the kids normally playing, probably not. So what I'm looking at is overtly looks just like a desk with one chair right behind it, as if someone would have just sat there, and another chair that is just tumbled over. And the whole installation is called The Deserted Room, and it's here really to remember kind of the idea of how Jews were dragged out of their respective apartments and were deported, and how they respectively left then these deserted spaces behind. And it's a very powerful kind of installation because of sorts, as you're coming across it, it doesn't come along with a huge inscription that immediately alerts you to its significance, but it rather is kind of confusing at first, and you have to come a bit closer only then to realize that it sits on a kind of metal base of sorts and is surrounded by words from a poem by Nelly Saxon. I think, Angie, you have it.
Yes, I can read the poem. Oh, the houses of death, invitingly appointed, for the landlord of the house who was once a guest. Oh, you fingers, laying the threshold, like a knife between life and death. Oh, you chimney stacks, oh, you fingers, and the body of Israel going up in smoke.
Very powerful lines, and they speak to you in a particular way as you're kind of deciphering them, trying to make sense out of this installation that overtly is just really out of metal, though, a big desk with two chairs and without any kind of clear markers initially for you to identify as it being relevant or invoking the Holocaust, but then it does in many ways. And it reminds you really that in all these lovely houses that surround this park, here and there, as you're also often reminded by these stumbling blocks, Jews lived. The Jews in many ways were not foreigners, they were not strangers, they were neighbors here, whoever at the time when they were deported left these empty places behind. I'm moving us now a little bit onward, or talk about two other really interesting installations. Part of what I think is fascinating to see here is the kind of various memorializations that have occurred here in the city, both in the more centralized manner, the Jewish Museum on the one side, or the big memorial to the murdered Jews, but then really, as we were trying to say, also more in these more localized spaces. What I'm moving toward is otherwise known as the missing house. The missing house brings up a really interesting rediscovery by an artist called Boltanski. I don't know, Angie, do you have anything on this that you want to share with us?
The house was actually destroyed during the bombardment during World War II. It's interesting when you look at the houses on either side of it, you can see how close they are together. The two on the either side didn't sustain as much damage as the one in the center, which it was demolished because of the bombing. The house that was destroyed was left not reconstructed. So you see the absence, the void that was created by the destruction.
Once you arrive in Grunewald, it's a normally functioning train station with, you know, various kind of regional trains coming in and out. But then you're quickly directed also to one of the tracks, which is called Gleis 17, track 17, which is a memorial track. And it's from here that Jews were deported, as well as from other places in Berlin. But first and foremost, this is where the first deportations occurred. Today, this is a larger memorial space that commemorates the deportations of Jews. With this kind of abundant train track, trees are growing, leaves are falling, and all in all, what one sees here is really a constant listing of all the individual deportations as they occurred. From the very beginnings of 1941 all the way to the last deportations of March 1945. Now, what's really remarkable about the site is that in many ways it's not just simply abundant, but the train tracks quite literally go into a tree line as a way to suggest that nature has really overpowered whatever this train station could have continued to be at some point or another. No trains will ever arrive any longer here, nor will any trains depart from here. It's a site that it doesn't attract a great deal of attention, in particular not now, the kind of colder months of the year, but one sees throughout still little commemorative lights, flowers that were left behind, as well as some candles that are still on here and there. Each one of those markers out of metal designated really to commemorate one of the deportations. So I'm just kind of walking across to the end of this track line right now, just to kind of get us to the beginning of the chronology. And then we're kind of walking back, so to speak, to the center of the train station itself. So each one of these kind of calls out the individual deportations, as I've already said, and kind of walking down along them, one quickly realizes the steady pattern by which they were orchestrated. So if we just kind of get to the beginning here, I think we're learning right away something quite remarkable, and that is that the first deportation from Berlin occurred actually on the 18th of October 1941, and it included 1,251 Jews, as it says here, from Berlin, who were deported to Lodz. Now, I think this is remarkable, and we should just remember this for a moment, because in many ways we associate often the Wannsee Conference that occurred in January of 1942 as the kind of literal beginning. But in many ways, Wannsee was really, as we often say, really the point only where everyone was brought together as a way of thinking about the implementation of the Holocaust. In many ways, it had already begun here, quite literally, with the first deportations, again, on October 18th, 1941, 1,251 Jews from Berlin to Lodz. But it keeps going in the same kind of steady pattern, carefully orchestrated from the offices here in Berlin that repeatedly, you know, orchestrate the roundups and then the marches of the Jews to the station, in particular during the early days, and then the deportation from here to Theresienstadt. If we now move to the other direction of the train tracks, we're moving in the timeline, not upward. We're getting to the end of 1942. And this kind of steady pattern continues throughout 1943 all the way into 1944 until the very last deportation occurs here from 1945. But much of 1943 now is really marked by the constant deportations to Auschwitz. So Theresienstadt is barely any longer mentioned. It's just now all the Jews are immediately deported from Berlin directly to Auschwitz. Obviously, as we're walking down the timeline, much has changed in the war. The Germans had already conceded their defeat at Stalingrad. But in many ways, the deportations onward to the east, and in particular to Auschwitz, continue undisturbed. And we're entering now the kind of last tail end. But even now, as the Soviets are already starting to move toward Berlin here on the 2nd of February 1945, there are still 23 Jews being deported, in this case to Ravensbrück and Sachsenhausen. On the 2nd of February, 38 Jews are being deported to Theresienstadt. And on the 27th, which is the very last one, the 27th of March 1945, still 18 Jews are deported from Berlin to Theresienstadt. Walking up and down these lines, one realizes that the deportations were carried out with a great attention to detail, and that there is a pattern that, you know, emerges over time and a steady rhythm by which they've occurred. This memorial site, in many ways, makes also another point quite obvious, and that is that these deportations occurred in a very steady stream in plain daylight, and involved obviously a great deal also of coordination and involvement of the train systems and so on and so forth. This is a very, very telling and very powerful memorial, and it breaks down rather this large number of over 50,000 Jews who were deported from Berlin into these smaller numbers, and therefore makes this somehow on some level a little bit easier to follow, but also to understand the kind of ongoing commitment that persisted throughout these years, from the very first deportations from the fall of 1941 to the last deportations of spring 1945. Have to kind of keep up my big strides here because it's cold. It's Berlin. We're close to December. It's 8 p.m. and it's cold. And so I'm going to keep up a little bit my fast walking here to kind of get ourselves to where we want to start our quick turnaround. You know, by now this part, even though it used to be East Berlin and has really transformed itself, so I'm walking around streetcars, a big Nike store. Across there is a kind of natural place where you can buy sustainable clothing and sustainable beauty products. So in lots of ways, the East and West, all of this has really changed ever since the wall came down in 1989. But what I want to draw now attention to is the centerpiece of this area, which is the famous synagogue in Oranienburger Straße. It was dedicated and opened up in 1866. At the time when it was opened, it was the tallest building in Berlin. In other words, it stood out. Its dedication was really a public event. Lots of local dignitaries, including Bismarck, were in attendance. The press covered it. The local, the national, and even the international press covered this tremendous moment in the history of Berlin Jews. Also because the synagogue really stood out also in terms of its style. It was one of these synagogues that adopted what came to be known as a Moorish style, interested in, you know, visually representing itself in a distinct way, not to be mistaken, for example, as a church. And that synagogue itself became the home for much of Berlin Jews, the kind of centerpiece. Alongside with it emerged other various important institutions, two most notably the centers of learning, kind of adjacent street, the Artilleriestraße, one of center of learnings for liberal Judaism called the Hochschule, and the other one for Orthodox Jewry called Das Israel. The synagogue then, unfortunately, like many others, suffered destruction in 1938, when it was set on fire, and then was pretty much left in this half-decayed, half-destroyed state for a while, only then to be hit more during the war, and then ultimately, though, being more fully destroyed in the 1950s, when the GDR really didn't have the resources to preserve buildings, nor were they particularly interested in preserving any types of buildings. But also they made a simple calculation that that synagogue that could house up to 3,000 people was never going to service again a Jewish community of that size. You move forward into 1989, the wall came down, and eventually there's big efforts being made to kind of preserve again that building. And if you stand nowadays outside of it, like I do right now, you see the building again, also you think in its former glory. It has the golden dome and it looks stunning. However, once you go inside, which I've done actually during the day, you realize that while the synagogue was restored from the outside, it was never fully restored again in the inside. So as you're walking through the building, you're constantly exposed again to the bricks and mortars that had been destroyed. And the actual synagogue itself was never rebuilt. So it's an interesting way of what they call critical reconstruction or critical preservation, a preservation of a historical site that restores some of its original appearance, but also preserves the kind of markers of its destruction. So it's both the presence and the absence that are equally there. But I've now moved us already quickly to what's called the Große Hamburger Straße. Like I said, it's cold and I'm walking very quickly. Right here at the beginning is a really important historical site. It's the original Jewish cemetery. This is where kind of one of the icons of Berlin Jewry, Moses Mendelssohn, is buried. This is where you have memorials placed on the outside. This is actually the place where one of the homes for elderly Jews was placed, which ultimately became a place where, from where Jews were deported in larger numbers. And now we are walking onwards, and we're going to get, I think, very soon to our first stumbling stones, if I'm not mistaken. Angie, can you tell us a little bit about these Stolpersteine?
There are actually over 8,000 of them, and they are little plaques that are in the concrete meant to memorialize victims of the Nazis. And the majority of them, most of the 8,000, are meant to memorialize Jewish victims. But there are also a few scattered around that also memorialize those other victims of Nazi persecution.
So one of the interesting things nowadays about the stumbling blocks is that they are also all to be found online. So you can kind of go onto a website and you can search for particular stones, or you can search for stones in a particular area. And you understand something thereby also by, you know, by the ways by which they spread in terms of where Jews lived. And one of the things that you realize by looking at the stumbling blocks that exist for Berlin, the Jews live pretty much everywhere in Berlin, that they never were in the 20th century relegated to a particular neighborhood. What I'm walking through here was part of the kind of beginning, so to speak, of Jewish life. But in the 20th century, obviously, Jews had spread far and across. So I'm coming across the first stumbling block. Angie, you want to talk to us a little bit more about that one?
Yes, if I am correct, I think you're referring to the one about Herbert Budzelowski. He was the son of a Berlin merchant, and he came from a religious Jewish liberal family. His bar mitzvah actually took place at the synagogue that you were just discussing, so there's a tie there. In 1933, he became a member of a Jewish youth group, and in 1936, he joined another liberal-oriented Jewish youth group. This one actually caught the attention of the Gestapo, and they investigated many of the members of this group, so he was targeted. And among the allegations, of course, being Jewish, but also he was suspected of having close friendships with other young men and other young communists within the group. He's one of those victims that was accused of homosexual activities. On top of that as well, he was accused of an arson attack against the Nazi exhibition in 1942, and he went into hiding. After a very short amount of time, he was arrested in 1942. He was taken to prison where a sentence was carried out against him. He was killed at the age of only 22.
Very interesting. But it kind of gives away one of the kind of essential components about these stumbling blocks is that each one of them exposes you to one particular aspect of this bigger history that we usually, you know, put together under the big heading of the Holocaust. And one of the interesting things is really as you walk through the city of Berlin, you come across these individual stones that mark Jewish victims and others, like in this case. And every time you're confronted with an individual fate, which then, if you keep walking in certain neighborhoods, it will quickly, you know, a wider kind of panorama, so to speak, will be assembled. But here, what I find interesting is also just as we just noted this particular stumbling stone, then I'm standing adjacent to a church. It's called the Zofim Kirche, if I'm not mistaken. And it's a place that is in other ways quite remarkable because this is a place where Martin Luther King preached in September 1964. And in lots of ways, it's kind of this juxtaposition of these various historical markers of stumbling stones on the one side, of an inscription that marks the presence of Martin Luther King speaking out, obviously, against racism, that creates a very kind of richly textured neighborhood. I mean, remember, when I'm walking around, people otherwise go shopping, they have maybe some fries or some other food, or they live here. So I'm not walking through a memorial space as such, but it's just a space that is very clearly marked. I mean, I'm walking just by just another two memorial stones, and all of this is in a very kind of residential area, really, where people are just confronted with part of Berlin's history just because they're, like I am, maybe walking around in the evening, or apparently they are here to do shopping or have their hair done or whatever they do, or what brings them out on a day or night as well. So there's obviously a very different way of thinking about the Holocaust if one follows it. It's kind of memorialization in these more regional or smaller parts of Berlin rather than just through the major museums. Not to say that the museums and memorials are not important, but I think it's also significant to recognize that for most Berliners, they'll encounter part of the history in a much more daily setting as they are bringing their kids to school or as they're going shopping or fulfill any other of their mundane day-to-day activities. I think that concludes our walk through Berlin. Thank you again for being here with me.
This podcast is hosted by a team of dedicated faculty and research assistants at the Ackerman Center for Holocaust Studies. You can learn more about our work and find upcoming events at our website, www.ackerman.utdallas.edu.